This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. The average cost of a wedding today in the United States is reported to be in excess of $25,000. Could that be? Are couples spending the equivalent of 7.5 months of the average American salary to be married? Those figures led journalist Rebecca Mead to wonder just what this says about life in America at the outset of the 21st century. It also led her to this question, what is a wedding for? Those are a couple of the questions Mead set out with when she began doing the legwork for her book, One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. Mead, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is our guest in this portion of the program. Rebecca Mead was born in London. She was educated at Oxford and NYU. She's been on the staff of The New Yorker since 1997. Although One Perfect Day is not a memoir, Rebecca Mead was wed halfway through the research and writing of One Perfect Day. One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding, is published by the Penguin Press. Rebecca Mead, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
What led you to your interest in the wedding industry?
I thought that weddings provided an incredibly interesting lens through which to look at American culture. You know, it's a very, very big business. And there are 2.3 million marriages every year. So this is something that touches almost all of us at some point in our lives. And it just seemed a very provocative and interesting lens for me to look at the way we live now. I think that the way we marry says a lot about who we are.
Yeah. There are, you report, about 2.3 million marriages in America every year. And no two weddings are exactly the same. Yet, as you point out, weddings are also profoundly conformist. So who sets the parameters for what's acceptable and what's not?
Well, one of the things that I thought about a great deal while I was doing the research for One Perfect Day was exactly this question. And I think that the authorities that used to govern the way that we do things like weddings, which is to say religious institutions and the sort of larger dictates of family and social propriety, those things are less significant than they used to be in many people's lives. And what has taken their place, what's sort of stepped into this vacuum of authority, is the commercial wedding industry. I mean, people want to be told how to do something as important as a wedding, but increasingly the authority to which they turn to be told is the same authority that's selling them the stuff to do it. And so there's inevitably an escalation and a commercialization of what a lot of us would prefer to think of as something that's not really to do with money.
Yeah. What leads women to the traditional trappings of a wedding, if I can use that word, trappings, that's kind of loaded, I guess. And what leads other women to take a less than traditional or untraditional approach?
Well, the word traditional is a very loaded one within the wedding business. I mean, the wedding industry talks about the traditional bride, and by that they mean somebody who is game for all of the trappings or most of the trappings that they have to offer. I mean, I came across an article in a magazine called Vows Magazine, which is a trade magazine for bridal store retailers, and it advised how to approach the so-called non-traditional bride. And one way to recognize the non-traditional bride was that she's more focused on the marriage than on the wedding. So from the perspective of the wedding business, to be traditional is to be sort of immersed in their world and in their the fantasy that they're offering, that you can create this perfect self and have this perfect day. But this is a very appealing idea for women, I think, that you know, you're participating in something larger than yourself, and you're participating in something that has a kind of historical gravitas, at this very, very significant moment in your life. I mean, one of the things that I discovered, though, is that many of the things that are passed off as tradition or are sold with the air of tradition are not really as traditional as we might think.
Yeah, you use the word traditional-esque.
Yeah, I use the word traditional-esque to mean things that have sort of the air of tradition but aren't terribly traditional, really. I mean, one of the traditional-esque things that I investigated was Disney World's weddings program, and they offer what they describe as a very traditional ceremony. Of course, there's nothing very traditional about getting married on the fringes of a theme park. You know, your grandmother didn't do it, but nonetheless, it's sold as this kind of, you know, emerging with the past. You know, it's a past that's based more upon fairy tales and Disney cartoons than upon the reality of the past, but it's the fantasy of the past.
Yeah, I think, though, maybe what we could talk about is the true traditional bride, and I would say that bride is really more concerned about the marriage than the wedding.
Well, you'd hope so, wouldn't you? And
yeah.
Certainly, you know, that's what I think we should all be focused on when approaching a wedding. We should all really be thinking about what comes next. But the average engagement period in the United States now is 16 months. And so when you become a bride, which is to say you become engaged, you are the focus for a significant period of time of this very powerful marketing machine that is trying to make you turn your wedding preparations into yet another kind of consumer experience.
Would you give our listeners a sense of the range of products and services that are marketed to brides today?
Yeah, well, there's the president of the Association of Bridal Consultants, which is a trade organization for professional wedding planners, you know, which itself is a newly emerging profession, he told me that it took 43 different the services of 43 different professionals to stage the sort of standard American wedding these days, and that includes everybody from the guy that rents you the tent to put up in the backyard, or on the person that makes the dress, the person that tailors the dress, the person that makes the cake, the person that manufactures the wedding favors that you send your guests home with, the person who impersonates a clown to entertain your guests, children, so they don't disrupt the party, and so on and so on and so on. And it's a sort of ever proliferating number of people who have recognized that this is a very attractive consumer. They know that this is an occasion, especially in a woman's life, when she is willing to pay full price, something she may not choose to do in almost any other sphere of her life, but on this day she wants to do it properly. And you know, it's well known in the wedding business. This is you can get these women to pay full whack.
Hmm. To what extent are grooms involved in the production of this one perfect day?
I think increasingly they are, because increasingly they're helping to pay for it. It used to be the case that weddings were paid for by the bride's father, or at least that was the tradition. And increasingly, weddings are paid for by not just the bride's father, but also the bridegroom's parents and the bride and groom themselves. And very often, it's the bride and groom paying the entire tab. So if the man is paying for half, paying for the party, he's going to want to have a say in it. And I think, you know, grooms are recognizing that this is, you know, a significant event in their day, in their lives, too. And the idea also is very prevalent now that weddings are an expression of the personality of the couple involved. You know, it's not supposed to be anymore a sort of conformist thing, although, you know, as I say, it's one of the most conformist things you can do to get married. But, you know, the idea is that every wedding is supposed to express the personality of the couple involved. So, you know, that includes the man.
The figure, the average cost of a wedding, that figure, $27,852, is just stunning to me. Where does that come from?
It comes, as do most of the statistics about the wedding business, from the wedding industry itself. I mean, one of the unfortunate things in looking at this business is that nobody collects data from outside, and there isn't really any way to do so. So all of the numbers are, and this is something I write about a little bit in One Perfect Day, is, you know, what to make of these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the numbers, which are generally accepted in the industry, come from the Condé Nast Bridal Group, which is the publisher of Brides, Modern Bride, Elegant Bride, and their associated websites. And they are sort of turned to as the authority for what, what people are spending. Now, whether you can, you know, entirely accept their numbers or not, one of the things that they do indicate is what the industry is telling people is an acceptable amount of money to be spending on a wedding. So if they're, and these numbers are released every year, and every year they go up, and you know, it's the message is put out there that mm-hmm. it's okay to spend that it's going to cost you $28,000, and that if you don't spend $28,000, if you only spend $15,000, you're doing brilliantly because you're doing it cheap, and if you spend more than that, well, you've only just gone a little bit over. I mean, it starts to become a reasonable number if it's repeated often enough, you know, and people don't stop to think how much this is, you know, in terms of the average American salary or what they could get. Well, you know, towards a down payment on a house or so on.
Yeah. Well, to each his own, I guess, but it seems to me it's just outrageous. And, you know, these are reasonable people, right?
Yes. I mean, and it's you know, I think people are, I'm not suggesting that people are just being sort of hoodwinked by an evil industry. That's much too simple, and it's not, you know, in order for this to work, it has to speak to some people's sense of need, of wanting ceremony, of wanting sort of to make a magnificent statement. So it appeals in a very profound emotional way, and I think supplies meaning in a way that, you know, having a wedding itself supplies meaning that in some ways the transition from not being married to being married no longer supplies. For many of us, you know, there's not that much difference in practical terms between how we are the day before we get married and how we are the day after. And so having a wedding is one way of telling yourself that you've really, you know, that a big change has happened, that something really happened.
So we do still think of it as a rite of passage, even though our day-to-day life might not be changed profoundly.
Yes, I think we want it to be a rite of passage, you know, because it's important for people to have that sense of something significant happened here. And people want to belong to a tradition, and they want to belong to, you know, participate in a larger community. And all those things are what a wedding, we hope, is. What I'm interested in is the way that those impulses and those, you know, those very real impulses are picked up and played upon and turned to the advantage of this enormous industry.
Hmm. It seems to me that we need rites of passage, and that not only is the wedding a rite of passage that we have embraced, but there are other days of celebration now in our lives that are becoming more and more... what's the word I'm searching for? Larger, bigger. You need a planner, let's say, for a bar bat mitzvah, mm-hmm. or prom, or there are ethnic groups that have what amounts to coming out parties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And these are becoming more and more extravagant.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things happening. I mean, one is, you know, we live in a very consumer-oriented society, and these events that we think of as sort of family events are actually, you know, increasingly turned into professionalized events. There is a professional tier of people who will supply the services for these kinds of things. Certainly, in the case of weddings, I mean, I think that there's a way in which this is, you know, a reflection of the busyness of our lives, and especially women's lives. It used to be that the women within a family would plan a wedding, and you know, now one has to turn to a professional wedding planner because everybody's got a job, everybody's too busy. You know, people might wonder whether the sort of big white wedding is a repudiation of feminism, and I think in a sense there's a sense in which it's a consequence of feminism, that, you know, one of the things that women have been freed from having to do is spend time planning their daughters' weddings. You know, they're too busy having a job for themselves, and so you know, so we turn to a professional tier to help us with these things now.
How many wedding planners are there?
Well, there's an association called the Association of Wedding Planners that has about 4,000 members, I believe, and then there are more than that that are, you know, not members of the association. But the one that I wrote about was the Association of Bridal Consultants, and they have, you know, close to 4,000.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Jerry and Eileen Monahan.
Well, they were the founders and the president and vice president of the Association of Bridal Consultants, which is this organization for professional wedding planners, and they do. They're no longer the president. They've surrendered that role to somebody else. But they still do teaching seminars around the country on telling people how to become wedding planners. And I attended one of these seminars, which was fascinating. It was a very mixed group of women. It was all women, but it was very mixed racially. And these were all people who aspired to make planning events their, you know, their profession.
Mm-hmm.
And we were given all kinds of useful tips, like if you are going to have a visit with a potential client, you know, if you drive to her house rather than have her come to you, then you'll be able to see what kind of car she drives, and you'll be able to guess how much money she's got and how much she's going to spend on the wedding. There are all kinds of, you know, very intriguing little tricks that that one might apply to this new business.
Yeah. What leads these folks to this business?
You know, people get into it because, or are first attracted to it, I think, because, you know, they like weddings. They like the idea of working with brides. I mean, it's actually very, very hard work to do it. And you know, I think if you like weddings, it's probably not, you know, it's probably better just to go to them rather than to try and work them professionally. But, you know, people want to participate in this special day. And, you know, it's also, as I said, a growing market. And there's the understanding that, as one wedding industry consultant said to me, you know, there are three occasions in a person's life when more money is spent, and that's birth, marriage, and death. And I try to get as much as I can in those mm-hmm. occasions. And so there's the hope that, you know, this is something that could turn into a real, you know, real business.
Yeah. Speaking of money, and you mentioned earlier the magazine Vows magazine.
Yeah.
It offers advice to retailers. And this was a piece of advice that you picked out from the magazine. Just when the bride thinks she'll have to spend no more, it's your job to remind her that her bridal image looks incomplete.
That's right. I mean, the bridal stores, you know, depend upon getting the brides to buy the veil, the gloves, the shoes, the tiara, all those other things, in addition to the dress, because, you know, they may not make an enormous profit markup on the dress, but, you know, on those things that they can really do a decent markup. So it's assumed that the bride is going to, you know, you have to, the rule of thumb is you have to get her to spend pretty much as much again on additional things. I learned about a fascinating thing called the Oh Mommy moment when I was at a training seminar for retailers. And the Oh Mommy moment is when the young woman is in the bridal store with her mother, and she's trying on gowns, and she puts one on, and she looks at herself, and she sees reflected back at herself, you know, her ideal vision of herself as a bride. She looks perfect, and she says, "Oh, mommy," you know, and that's, you know, the peak of her emotional connection with herself as a bride. And that's the moment at which the retailer is then supposed to say, you know, "You need a veil with that. Let me go and get you a tiara. You know, how about a bag?" And, you know, that's when you come in. If you're the retailer, you come in for the hard sell.
Yeah. It's time to sell some jewelry.
Exactly.
Those gloves, do I guess I haven't been to a wedding for a while. I guess that tells you where I am and how old I am. But are brides still wearing those long gloves?
Well, I mean, the bridal stores will try to persuade you to.
Yeah.
I accompanied a bride to the Vera Wang boutique in New York, and one of the salespeople there was very eager to tell us that she had, she tried to persuade all of her brides to wear gloves. Not the ones, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, not the ones that came up over the elbow. That was not cool. But the shorter ones were the stylish ones that she was trying to get, you know, not just brides, but also beauty magazine, fashion magazines to use, so that they would become a trend and so that people would buy them.
I do expect that I will soon, one of these days in the not-too-distant future, go through a period where I will be going to weddings because I'm a boomer, and I expect that I will be going to Echo Boomers weddings.
Right, right. Well, the Echo Boom are the offspring of baby boomers, and they are a very attractive group to the wedding industry because they are quite conservative. They're not rebellious as your generation was, but are, you know, their top values are, you know, family. They want a good job. They want to get married, and And they also, you know, have grown up in a very, very much in a consumer culture. And so they're used to expressing themselves through the products that they choose. So, you know, the wedding industry has its eye, collective eye on this consumer very, with great excitement.
Mm. I wonder what the children of the Echo Boomers will do.
Well, it's a good question, isn't it, whether they will follow the traditions that the Echo Boomers are. I mean, this idea that you can start new traditions, which is something that one hears all the time in the wedding business, you know, start your own tradition, as if tradition was not something that was actually handed down but could be begun from zero by you, yourself. And one of the new traditions that is being sort of popularized among this group is the idea of incorporating your pet into the ceremony, because people now think of their pets as part of their family, and you can buy little wings to go on the back of a dog, or a little wreath, floral wreath or something to go on a dog's head. So, you know, we'll have to wait another, you know, 30 years or something to see whether the children of the Echo Boom you know, carry on with the dog tradition.
Yeah, either that or they turn to us old folks and say, "Granny, I don't want to have nothing to do with that." And we'll say, right on. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Rebecca Mead. She's a staff writer for The New Yorker. She is the author of One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Join us with the telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The people who work in the wedding industry, they're in it, by and large, as you said, because they're drawn to, I guess, the pageantry of the wedding. But when it comes to their attitudes about marriage, and when it comes to that question, what is a wedding for? How do they think about those questions?
It's funny, you know. So, I mean, if you try to talk to people in the wedding business about the marriages that they are involved with producing, their ceremonies to start, you know, they'll be, you know, in some cases very hesitant to even address the fact that there's a marriage going on in the, you know, in this production. I mean, I interviewed Colin Cowie, who's one of the best-known wedding planners in the country. He does a lot of TV and has done work with Oprah and all kinds of things. And at the time I interviewed him, he was doing some work with JCPenney's bridal registry business and so on. And I asked him, you know, what did he know what the success rate, as it were, of the marriages that his weddings started was, you know, how many divorces? And he said, "You know, honey, I just don't care. I just get them down the aisle." You know, I mean, he was refreshingly cynical about it. I mean, much of it, you know, much of the wedding business, when one talks to these people, there's an awful lot of sentimentality. And he was, you know, refreshingly unsentimental, let us say. But you know, it's very, the people in the wedding business, you know, don't necessarily focus on the marriage that comes to follow. That's not always what they're interested in. Although, you know, in terms of something like the bridal registry business, you know, that's very significant what happens next, because if you're a department store and you get the custom of the bride, you know, as a registry client, then the hope is that she'll go on to buy products from you forever and ever and ever. So so the future life of the bride is an interesting one to them, but it's the future life of the bride as a consumer, not as a half of a marriage.
Yeah. Let's talk with a listener now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi, you're on the air with Rebecca Mead.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, gee, this is exciting. I'm well beyond the age where I have to worry about this, except maybe grandchildren. But this is, I just wanted to call in to tell you how much I'm enjoying all these revelations. Of course, I was kind of aware of the pitches that were made, but it seems like you've got it all nailed down almost as an expose. So continue on and let me listen, and thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And let's take another call now. A listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I just got back for the second half of the show. I heard about it earlier, and I was kind of interested in finding out. I've been married and divorced and then remarried. And during the second, planning stage, I noticed that I think we did a lot of extra things that we didn't do the first time around. I kind of felt like my ex-wife and I didn't quite, do it up the way we wanted, and we didn't. So we ended up spending more money. Is that the norm? Do people usually go into the second marriage of spending more or spending less?
It's a great question. It used to be that second weddings were occasions, were much more modest occasions, and the bride wouldn't wear a white wedding gown, and she would wear a, perhaps just a nice suit or something, and it was smaller and much more modest.
Maybe even a justice of the peace.
Yeah, exactly. And these days, I think people see the second wedding as a real opportunity to get everything right that they didn't get right the first time. And that's not just, marrying the right spouse this time around, but also, having the right party and having, wearing, for the bride, wearing the dress she really wanted to wear, or, expressing herself in it now that she's mature, more mature and wiser, exactly as she wants to express herself. So second weddings are not, are not the modest events they used to be. I heard a wonderful story from a wedding planner who told me that she had planned a wedding for one bride who had clearly the marriage wasn't intended to be, and this bride had wept through every planning session and had, the wedding itself had not been a very happy occasion, and she'd not enjoyed the honeymoon. And she came back, and within a year, she was telling the wedding planner, "I'm getting a divorce." But she said to the wedding planner, "Next time I get married, I'm going to plan my wedding with you again." So she was already thinking about what the next celebration would be like.
Well, I know that with myself, we married young, and we didn't grow closer, we grew farther in my first marriage. And in our wedding, we just did a basic church wedding. We had a small group of, family and friends. We went to Florida for our honeymoon. We came back taking time to, after the divorce, going through some, a growth period and having time to, become an adult, basically, in my 30s, we totally went into this. I was excited about the person I was with. I thought I'd found a more well-rounded, emotionally, well-based person. And we got married at the Sunken Garden in Allerton Park. We had a big group of people. We had a big reception afterwards, where we only had a cake and ice cream reception the first time. We had food, the whole meal and everything for the second reception. And then we went to Hawaii during my, for our second honeymoon. It just seemed like everything had to be one-upped. And it wasn't, I don't really think during the time we were planning it that way. But in hindsight, I look back on it and I think, wow, that's what we did. We kind of stepped everything up so that it was just that much nicer. I don't know if that's just, the basic norm, or if some people just go into their second marriages going, well, I ain't doing that again because I might get divorced again, So, sorry, just a statement.
Yeah, no, I think it's very appropriate and it's very interesting. Rebecca?
Yeah, well, people want to celebrate this event. It's, it is a very significant occasion and transition in a person's life. And, I've been to weddings and I like going to weddings. And I mean, I'm not, I was married during the writing of this book. So, I'm not sort of anti-wedding in this book. What I'm trying to do is understand about what this says about us as a culture, and I think it speaks to this very persistent need and desire on the part of people to have this day feel significant.
Yeah, I entirely understand. Well, congratulations on your wedding, and I'll just. Thanks
for the call.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, how did you go about it?
Getting married?
Yeah.
We had a pretty small wedding. I mean, I got married on a Thursday afternoon by a judge in New York with a handful of family and friends, and then we had a party in a house that my husband and I already lived in on the weekend afterwards. So the Sunday after the Thursday, and it was very fun, and it was lovely, and it wasn't a big production, and it wasn't something that required an awful lot of planning beforehand, and I was focused upon, I really wanted, yeah, I was more focused upon what was going to happen
afterwards,
we were married than on the process of, you know, the getting married. I wasn't very interested in being a bride.
You were almost an elopement then.
Well, not quite. Not quite, because we did it at home, so you can't really, you know, get much closer to home than home. But the elopement is an interesting concept these days. I mean, it used to be that eloping meant you were escaping disapproving family or disapproving society. And these days, increasingly, I think elopement means getting away from the wedding business. And people say, oh, we're not going to have all that big wedding. You know, we're not going to do it in the hometown in the rented ballroom with the this and the that. We're just going to go away and run away and do it on a beach somewhere. But the thing is that now there's an elopement industry as well. So if you may hope to escape it, but I went to while I was doing the reporting for One Perfect Day, I went to the island of Aruba, which has changed its marriage laws in order to make it easier for American couples to get married there, because they realized that there was a lot of tourist dollars in encouraging weddings to happen there. And since they changed the marriage laws, there's now 1 in 3 couples in Aruba who get married are American tourists.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's talk with some more listeners. Next we go to a caller on a cell phone, line 2. Hi.
Hi. Actually, I'm really enjoying the show. I just wanted to kind of pose a question and a comment. When I got married about 8 years ago, I actually used a book by Debbie and Alan Field, I believe, about trying to have the best wedding ever but doing it very cheaply. And I just wanted to know what Rebecca's thoughts were on that, and if she knows the book.
Yes, I do know the book. It's a very much a sort of consumer guide, you know, how to avoid getting ripped off, and gives you sort of useful hints about, you know, don't say that you're planning a wedding when you call the hotel or whatever. And I think people do find it very useful. I mean, my focus was not so much on, you know, it's my book isn't exactly a, you know, how to or a how not to, for that matter, but it's looking at weddings and the wedding industry from a cultural perspective and asking what does this tell us about how we live, and I hope it's also, I mean, one of the callers earlier said, oh, it's not really for me because I'm not involved in weddings right now. You know, I didn't write it solely for people who were planning weddings or were thinking that they might plan a wedding. I mean, the hope is that it's an interesting vantage point upon the way that we live now.
Hmm. Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener on line 1 in Urbana. Hi.
Hi. First, I'd like to say thanks for having this speaker. It's been really interesting. But I'd like to have an observation and a question. The observation is that, I guess, I'm 30, and most of my friends seem to be getting married now. And I've had two friends, one friend that was married last year and one that's going to be married soon. And they've both sort of opted out of the whole marriage industry thing. So they've, for example, one, she made her own dress, and they didn't have a caterer. They did all the food themselves. But at the same time, they're still scaled up their wedding, so they, both of these people, they wanted to have their wedding last for an entire weekend, and they did it at a camp, and they expected everyone to come and stay, and it ended up costing quite a lot of money, even though they didn't go down some of these traditional paths. And so I was wondering, if this is sort of an unusual thing, or if you've come across it before, and if it's true that, you know, in addition to what's going on sort of within the marriage service industry, people of my generation are sort of scaling things up just independent of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the idea that a wedding is no longer just one day, but it's a sort of three-day event, has become very common. I spoke to one older gentleman while I was writing the book, who said to me, who'd recently married, had two daughters who both married, and he said to me, when did the softball game become part of the wedding? Because it seems like everybody has a softball game the day before or the day after. So it's become, you know, this escalating, multiple event occasion rather than just one afternoon. This is partly a result of, you know, people's friends live far and wide. You want to get everybody together. You do it for a few days, not just for this one event. But it's interesting that your friends also tried to scale it down at the same time as they were scaling it up. And I think that there's an awful lot of people who feel that, they recognize that they are being, that they have become this, as one person I interviewed told me, incredible marketer's target. Somebody else referred to the bride as the drunken sailor. Everybody wants to get her. You know, they know, couples now know that they are perceived in this way. And I think that, increasingly there's a sense of disquiet about the direction weddings are taking. And, people are saying, I don't want my wedding to be a venue for other people's commercial enterprise.
Thanks.
You're very welcome. Let's talk with another listener in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Hi. I noticed in looking at the bridal magazines that so many of the ads are selling magic and enchantment. Have you encountered that?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, this is exactly what they do. They sell a fantasy of this perfect day, and the idea is that you spend your engagement period creating your perfect self, which is, you go on the diet and you go and you get your teeth whitened and you start to have facials every month so that you look beautiful on the day itself, as if every bride didn't look beautiful anyway. But no, it's selling a dream, isn't it? It's selling not just the dream that this day is going to be perfect, but that you will transform yourself into the creature of your own fantasy and will go on to live a perfect, happy, wonderful life thereafter.
That's what I noticed, that the bride is encouraged to think of herself as the princess or the queen for a day whose every whim must be indulged.
Exactly. And I think as well as the princess and the queen, I think she's encouraged to think of herself as a celebrity for the day. I mean, I think the influence of celebrity culture is huge, and so there's the idea that, your wedding day is your moment on the red carpet. This is your moment to be the star of the show.
Have you found any suggestion by these wedding industry people that the elaborateness or the expense of the marriage will contribute to the duration of the marriage?
There was a great study done in the 1960s, actually, which is a very, very entertaining study now. At this time, the wedding dress business was very, the people who manufactured wedding dress were very concerned that women were wearing mini dresses, not long gowns, and they released a study which revealed, conveniently enough for their own purposes, that if you got married in a long gown, your marriage stood a better chance of lasting longer than if you got married in a mini dress. I'm not sure that I really trust the science of that, but it's wishful thinking, isn't it? I mean, and we all know that the more elaborate the wedding, it really doesn't guarantee the happiness of the marriage. You only need to look at Princess Diana and Prince Charles for that one.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Rebecca Mead, our guest. She's the author of One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. It says, if that by beginning with that one perfect day, we'll live happily ever after. When did the word bridezilla first appear? And is this idea of a bridezilla, is it real?
The word first emerged around 2000, or at least that's when it really entered the public consciousness in a big way. And I think it's very, very telling. The Bridezilla caricature is this figure of a woman who becomes obsessed with her wedding to the exclusion of all other interests and assumes that everyone else is obsessed with it to the exclusion of all other interests too, and she becomes a sort of monster, a bridal monster. At this time, in around 2000, you started to get magazine articles and newspaper articles about the antics of the Bridezilla and books and TV shows and all the rest of it. And I think that when something like that grasps the public imagination in the way that this caricature clearly did, you have to ask yourself, what else is going on here? What's the bigger picture here? It's not just a case of a handful of brides going off the rails, but what I think it points to is a much larger disquiet about the direction that weddings are taking in this country at large. And I think that many people, although nobody wants to be, no one wants to be down on weddings or anything so happy as a wedding, I think that many, many people feel when they go to weddings, is it really all this for one day? Why so much money spent, so much effort invested? Is it really worth it for this one day? And I think that the Bridezilla figure, in a way, serves to sort of quarantine those feelings. So we siphon them off onto the Bridezilla, and we make fun of her rather than asking ourselves, is there something wrong? Is there something a little awry about the way that we conduct weddings as a culture at large?
Yeah. We're going to have to wrap up pretty quickly here, but I want to ask you before we go about what gay and lesbian couples are doing. How are they marrying?
Well, there's an emerging gay and lesbian wedding industry, which, unsurprisingly, as soon as the possibility emerged, then people in the wedding business started to think, how can we get in on this? It's very exciting because, It used to be thought that the wedding market was an inelastic market. You couldn't persuade people to get married by having a sale on bridal gowns or anything like that. Well, no, as it turns out, now there's a whole new market of bridal consumers or wedding consumers. It remains to be seen, really, whether gay weddings will become the same kind of production and events as straight people's weddings in this country are. We'll see.
Yeah. One last question. I thought this was such a fun little anecdote that you tell really early in the book in One Perfect Day. Way back in the spring of 1901, a trade journal for storekeepers called The Dry Goods Economist published a little article, and the title, June Brides, A Fair Mark. Did the author mean Mark as being the target of a con?
Yes, I think they did. Yes, I mean they had the bride in their sights back then and sooner, and further back. The wedding industry has been around for a while. The scale of it is something new, I think, and the questions about what role does it play in perpetuating and encouraging the fantasies that are built up around marriage and what that means. I think that is new too.
Yeah, weddings on steroids. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Rebecca Mead, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
A delightful read and so much fun talking with you this
Great,
afternoon.
Great, thanks a lot.
Rebecca Mead is the author of One Perfect Day, The Selling of the American Wedding. The book is published by the Penguin Press.